tragic accident changed the course of his life forever. For most, it would have begun a life of discontent and wallowing around in self-misery. For Jonathan Nadeau, it kickstarted a new chapter of inspiration and appreciation. Even though he lost his sight permanently, he gained a passion to put creativity first in all areas of his life. And now, he wants to encourage you to do the same. There are times when you'll be faced with a choice. Be crushed by the weight of the situation, or use the fresh start to rebound bigger, better, and more inspired than ever before. This is Tornado, stories of those who refuse to choose defeat and instead chose to embrace the storm. Here's your host, Jonathan Nadeau.
Greetings, welcome to Embrace Your Storm. I've got an awesome, exciting episode for you today. I'm speaking with Marlene, and I met her through the film festival that we're doing here at Tornado. And I'm just talking to her before the interview, and Marlene's got a lot of interesting things that we can talk about, so I'm excited. And so she owns Pink Poodle Productions. And Marlene, thanks for coming on today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is such a pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This is going to be so cool. But before we get too far into it, do you mind telling the audience know, like, you know, who you are, kind of where did you, not necessarily like where you grew up and stuff, but just how did you get involved in the kind of film and what started you down that path? Because part of this, the podcast here is to see like what makes you want to create using film as the your vehicle or platform that you've chosen.
Sure. Well, my name is Marlene Sharp. I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, and I moved to California early in my career, my educational career, to be in show business. That was the whole reason for landing in Los Angeles. And I did it incrementally. I came here by way of San Diego State University, where I went to graduate school. I have an MFA in musical theater. Oh, cool. And yeah, so the original goal was to be an actress. And I've always been interested in performing for film, TV, stage, all that stuff. And so I did it as much as I could in New Orleans. And then I thought, I'm too big for this town. And I thought that, like, around age 3 or so is when I decided I really needed to bail. And so I stuck it out for undergrad school in New Orleans, because my parents really discouraged me from breaking tradition of genteel Southern girls staying around in the neighborhood.
Right, yeah, their whole life.
Yeah. So I did that, but it just wasn't me. So I left and went to San Diego State, and then moved to Orange County for a year, and then ended up in Los Angeles, where I've been for 1 million years.
It probably looks like that. So like with Pink Poodle Productions, I guess we could maybe start with that, and then you could either go backwards a little bit of kind of how you got to doing Pink Poodle Productions, but let everyone know kind of like what that is, you're doing with it.
Sure. So that's my own company, Pink Poodle Productions. It's basically me and my dog, Blanche Dubois Sharp, who is right here tearing up her bed because she wants to be the center of attention on
I'm hoping,
podcast.
I'm hoping she's a poodle.
She's a poodle Bichon mix, but she identifies as a poodle.
There you go.
So so a little politically correct humor for you there. But we love Bichons and poodles equally. So but I didn't know if pink Bichons were a thing. It just seemed like pink poodles.
Yeah, exactly. It rolls off the tongue a lot better.
Yeah. And I had to get pink in there because that's my favorite color. So that's the deep, rich history of the name of my company. And it started as just a website for my consulting projects. So most of my career, I've been on staff at various companies. I've pursued a lot of freelance stuff as well, including acting jobs as a non-full-time employee for various places. But I've also had full-time, mostly executive, like executive in charge of production or executive, like development executive type positions. And so I really just wanted something to showcase all of the stuff that I've done. And it started as a glorified resume.
Sure. Yeah.
And then at the end of 2019, I lost my job. I was working full-time as the head of production out of Los Angeles for Level 5, which is a Japanese video game company known for Yo-Kai Watch and a number of other video game-driven intellectual properties. Yeah. And so I was working there, and they decided to pull back their international business and focus on the Japanese market. So they closed all the international offices, LA, Seoul, and Hong Kong. And that was the end of my job. So I still had my Pink Poodle website. So I thought, well, I don't have another job waiting for me. So guess what? Pink Poodle is now my full-time job.
Exactly.
And so that's what I did. And I have been fortunate, I was fortunate even from the get-go to have a number of consulting projects to keep me busy. And I've continued on in that fashion for the last 2.5 years. And that's the story.
Well, so one thing that I love that when we were talking is you're like, I am the biggest fan of LinkedIn. I am their biggest cheerleader.
And oh, yeah.
So I need you to tell people why you're the biggest fan of
LinkedIn. Oh, yeah. And well,
if you're listening, people, and you don't use LinkedIn, you're going to start using it after you hear her story.
Yeah. So I have been employed thanks to LinkedIn. And probably the biggest coup was my job at Sega. From 2015 till the end of 2017, my title was producer TV series for Sega of America in Burbank, California. And I was scouted and recruited on LinkedIn. It That's was a recruiter who found me, and it wasn't even from blindly applying to those black holes of application hell that's fairly typical and required for such things. My situation was that I was just contacted out of the blue, and now there was a rather diabolical interview process. I'm not going to lie about that. I probably had 10 interviews over the course of 2 months. So that happened.
Yeah.
But still, you know what? I would rather do 10 interviews than one online application.
Seriously, yeah. Especially the ones that make you like do some sort of like test or whatever before you even fill out the
application.
Yeah. It's like, no thanks.
That is so insulting and horrible. And I think the entire world should revolt against that. I mean, it's like, don't even get me started. But that was not the case with Sega of America and this wonderful recruiter who found me. But I really think the key to navigating LinkedIn in a way that you get noticed is just using it. Is just being on there a lot and not posting your own things definitely helps. But interacting with other people's posts.
Comments on posts and, stuff like actually like participating,
Exactly. Yeah. And even just, it might seem so trivial just to like somebody else's post, but it really can be the tipping point. Somebody will see that you liked their, and one of my favorite things is to like posts that nobody else has liked, because then the person who has posted it is so grateful, and you've basically made a friend for life.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how many really wonderful, talented people they don't post very often, and so their posts don't get noticed.
That's a very good
and Yeah, there's an opportunity. So it's not rocket science. It's just, thinking about human nature and how exactly. Everybody likes to be acknowledged.
Exactly. Now, I think throughout a lot of your career, you've been mostly involved, like you said, production, right? Production and
Development, which is all the stuff that happens before production and is often referred to as development hell, because it can last for many, many years. A good case study is the Sonic the Hedgehog movie, which was in development probably 10 years before the movie came out. Wow. Maybe if you count all the deal making and schmoozing and all the stuff that went before it, it was probably a good 10 years until the day that the first movie came out. So yeah, so that's been a big part of my career is doing all that stuff that leads up to a green light for production.
What do you like about that process? Like it does sound like it can be a really good experience, or it could be a really bad experience depending on the situation. But what is it about that process do you like? Do you like getting it finally finished, where you get that green light and you're saying, okay, now let's do this? You're like, yes, I got it done. Is it like what about that process do you like?
Well, that's where all the major creative decisions are made. Like, people are like lay people, the regular people are familiar with production because you see that, like, you see location shooting on the street, you see on the entertainment talk shows, you'll see behind the scenes footage of the shoots and stuff. Exactly. So that's the stuff that gets all the attention, but it's basically just crews showing up and doing what they're told, crews and actors. And it's not any decision making. The script isn't getting written there. Right. The production's not getting designed there. It's very tedious work, unless you're high up on the food chain, like a director. But even the director is planning stuff ahead of time in pre-production, sure, or development. They're not just showing up on the set and winging it,
on the fly, being like, oh, hey, here's a great idea.
Yeah, right. So none of the process is easy. I know it sounds like I'm a big baby saying, whatever.
I honestly am one of those lay people, because I mean, not that I thought everything was happening on the fly, but I mean, I thought, mm-hmm, quite a bit of it was sort of done, at that point. I didn't realize it was literally finished before they even started doing that. You know what I'm saying?
And if you think about also all the contracts that need to be done for every single person who is working on the set, plus all the intellectual property stuff, distribution, and none of those contracts can be done without creative decisions of, who are the right voices to speak for this project, like who's the proper screenwriter, and then also what is the story that we want to tell, what is the look that we want to show. So so my parents are forever telling me, like, oh, there's filming so many movies in New Orleans now, you can just move home and do that. And it's like, no.
it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, but oh my god, my dad, my mom and dad, but my dad just told me this story about some people in Metairie, which is the suburb where I grew up, and they rented their driveway to a production that needed to park a limousine for, what's his name, I'm blanking on the actor's name, Tommy Lee Jones. They rented their driveway because the production was actually renting a house for a location shoot next door, but they needed an extra place to park Tommy Lee Jones's limo. And so they rented their driveway for $100. And my dad was so excited to tell me that. And I was like, Dad, okay, thank you for telling me the story. There's so many things wrong with that story. And it's so does not apply to me at all.
I love those, your parents.
Yeah, I know. They're so cute. But yeah, you'd think that I would have started in this business like yesterday, the way they,
right. Yeah,
they
yeah.
have these revelations.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like you'd think you'd never had a conversation with them.
Yeah, but I know. It's anyway. Anyway.
Is there anything like you're working on? Like I mean, when you're doing production and stuff, is there anything you're working on story-wise? Have you done like your own stuff, or have you been finding yourself where people hire you to say, hey, here's my story and idea, but I need you to like execute it? Like, you know, what are you finding yourself doing more?
That is an excellent question. And the answer is that I'm able to live day to day by working on other people's projects. That's how I sustain myself, but my dream is to get my own projects off the ground. And I have sold and optioned projects in the past, and I have developed things for like as a commission, like someone else will,
okay,
you know, they'll pay me to develop things, but I have yet to see any of that stuff produced in a big way. It's okay. Just things get caught in development hell and then a lot of it relates to like regime changes at studios and companies. Like somebody who might be a champion of your project one day might leave that company, and then the new person won't be a champion, right. Or it's just not in their interest to forward your project to any extent. So, you know, there's all kinds of political reasons why you see what you see on screens. Yeah. And unfortunately, my stuff hasn't made it to the big time. I always say that like Tina Fey is having my career, because it seems that there's only room in this world for one Tina Fey, which is unfortunate, which is so unfortunate. But that's what I'd like to be doing, like creating my own projects and starring in them with Blanche. So I try to stay hopeful that maybe it's not too late. Maybe I'm the Betty White of my generation, and when I'm like 90, I'll really hit my stride. And that's when.
Well, hey, you know what? I read this book, probably within the last year or two. It's called Late Bloomers. And
I love it. I don't know it, but I already love it.
because you know, the point of the book, it talks about we live in this day and age now where we're seeing, you know, 20 somethings, 30 somethings being these like millionaire, billionaire, you know, kind of kid, right? And so this book was pointing out like, that's not normal. Like, you know, even though it seems like it happens a lot or whatever, it really doesn't. It's not normal. And like a lot of people really aren't successful until much later in life. And so the book points out all these people, and sadly, I can't remember any of them at all right now. But the point of it is like that these people in the list, it's like names you heard of and you're like, wow, they weren't successful until they were like 55. And it's like a name you felt like you've known forever. You know what I'm saying?
Wow. Okay. So, I'm buying that book today.
Yeah, no, it's called Late Bloomers. It's a great book. I highly recommend. Wow. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's
interesting. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Jonathan, maybe we need to start a podcast together called Late Bloomers.
That's fine with me, because I hope to be one of those. Like, no, not that I hope to be. I will be one of those. You know.
Yes. Yes. Well, you're already you're already there. So you're kind of an early bloomer.
No.
And you can be a late bloomer too. You can be both.
But I get what you're saying. Like I've been there. That's why I felt like I had to bring that up. Because it's a great book. It really will get you to change your mindset for real, you know?
I need that. With each passing year, I need that more and more.
And for anyone listening, I mean, honestly, like this day and age we live in, like I'm 43, so you just like, oh, forget it. I missed my, you know, opportunity or whatever, of sort of hitting it or whatever success means to you, right? You just feel like if you get past that age, you're like, forget it. It's over. I'm going to work my 9 to 5 now. But it's not the case. Like, you got to keep just working hard, and you know, you get out what you put into it. And a lot of these late bloomer people, that's how it worked. It was just a struggle for them. Like, they just kept having failures and successes and failures, and before you know it, you hit the big success, you know. And so,
yeah, I just to your point, I just read this great story from the Hollywood Reporter about Marla Gibbs, the actress from the Jeffersons, of course, but also 227, and she's been in a lot of movies and TV shows and everything. And I always loved the Jeffersons and 227. I love watching both of those shows. And so they did a profile on her just a couple of weeks ago. She turned 90, I think. Wow. And she looks fantastic.
I can imagine.
And I did not know this about her, but she didn't even move to LA to start acting professionally until she was 44.
Wow.
And yeah, she's from I either want to say Detroit or Chicago. I'm not sure, but she worked for an airline, and she was able to get transferred from the airline, transferred her to Los Angeles, and she kept her airline job.
Oh, she was recording the Jeffersons.
While she was on the Jeffersons, because she was too scared to, she thought, oh, this is not going to last. And so after like season two or something, somebody, one of the producers of the show was like, I think it's okay for you to, like, how can you even do two jobs? Like, this is going to kill you. And so she finally gave up the airline job, but she's like, she had been working for the airlines for like over 10 years, and she had built up retirement savings and whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was very aware of the capricious nature of show business, especially acting. And so she was, I think she had, she was a single mom as well.
Wow.
And so I think I could be wrong. I might be remembering this wrong, but I'm pretty sure that was part of it. And, but yeah, so she, and yeah, she's really, so I was like, okay, my new hero, Marla Gibbs. No, exactly. I mean, I loved her anyway, but I was like, I loved her even more now. Cause that's another thing. I never really felt like I could pursue acting 100%. Without having another job. And then what ends up happening is the other job takes over your life.
Exactly. Cause you're like, oh, I got to keep making money. I'm earning money, you know, whatever. And
yeah,
you know,
but I am fortunate in that I've always worked in the entertainment business, cause I didn't want to just like wait tables or sell insurance or what, not that there's anything wrong with those professions, but they're just not me.
That's not what you wanted.
And, and so, so I always pursued other avenues of the entertainment business, but it's quite stressful to have that double life like Marla Gibbs had. And it sounded like she did an amazing job, an amazing balancing act. I found that like in 2013, I reached a breaking point with that, and I had to really not go to auditions anymore. And I say that I'm offer only now for actors.
There you go.
For acting, because it was stressing me out so much to have to.
It's gotta be brutal.
And I've used every lie and excuse in the book to get out of my regular job to go to auditions and get. I mean, I was like James Bond in leading this double life, but it worked out sometimes. But other times, like what is really the worst, the most soul crushingest part of it is when you have to turn down an acting job, which are so few and far between, because something that you cannot miss with your other job, you cannot miss it or you will be fired. Mm-hmm. And so that happened to me a few times, and I was like, this is terrible. I can't do it anymore. It's too much. So Jonathan, this is your call to please cast me in something.
I'll find something for you.
So I don't have to audition, but I'll do a fine job for whoever hires me.
that's fine. I was going to say, well, so I know you said that brought you out there. So did you ever act, like, did, were you ever able to act in anything, or were you saying
that? Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I know I'm using this poor me routine. Well, no, and
I
everything,
know, but I just didn't know if you ever actually, cause you like you said, you have to work and then, you know,
yeah,
other things. So we, I just wasn't sure if you're able.
Yeah. To well, probably gigs. The most, no, I did a lot. All things considered, but it wasn't like long-term stuff that I could say, sure, like, oh, this is my,
yeah, yeah,
you know, this is my work now, this is my life. But probably the one of my proudest moments was I was in a very, very short-lived sitcom on NBC that also starred Steve Carell.
Okay.
It actually did pretty well in the ratings for all four episodes that aired, but just, and it was, the show was a star vehicle for a comedian named Tom Papa, who okay. is a protege of Jerry Seinfeld. And so Seinfeld didn't have any credit on the project, but it was rumored that he was like pulling the strings behind the scenes. Okay. And then everybody who worked on the show, like the directors, the executive producers, were Seinfeld alums. And then there was one Friends alum who was another of the executive producer slash creator. So it was like a who's who of sitcoms, which is always where I thought I belonged. And on the last day of filming, I cried like a baby to the casting director, and I was like, I don't want this to end. And she's like, oh, this is just the beginning. And it wasn't. I mean, it was I've never had an experience like that again. But I have done, you can check me out on IMDb and see my some of my acting credits on there. And
yeah,
I've done voiceover for a lot of Japanese
nice.
And Korean cartoons that need to be dubbed over in English. And that's my acting career. I try to keep hope alive that I can still do more with it before my time on earth is over.
Boy.
But yeah, we'll see. Yeah.
And I guess the one last thing I'll ask about is was the music video, one or two music videos you submitted to the festival, right?
Of the I forgot. Yes.
Ones. So what did you do with those? Like, did you do like the animation portion of those music videos?
Yeah. So they came from two different places that are not connected at all, except okay. through me. So one is, Kohima, the music video by my colleague Sahil Bhargava. So Sahil and I both work for Rainshine Entertainment, which is an Indian based company. So it's based in Mumbai, but there's a small team of us that work out of Los Angeles for Rainshine. And so right now our big project that we're working on is called Young Captain Nemo. It's a trilogy of animated feature films. But Sahil's title is the head of adult and teen animation, and my title is head of IP strategy and acquisitions. So we work very closely together. But in addition to that, because you know everybody in Hollywood is a multi-hyphenate, so Sahil is also a musician and plays multiple instruments, is a composer, a singer. And so during COVID, he wanted to release a number of singles, and he wanted to do music videos to correspond with them, but shooting live action wasn't really practical. Yeah. So he did them as animation, and I wasn't really that involved in the production process of that. It was a very small team in India that he worked with.
Yeah,
but I have a lot of experience in the film festival circuit and submitting things to festivals and panel discussion, all the bells and whistles that go along with film festivals. I've been in that world for a long time. So I said, well, let's put your stuff in some film festivals and see what happens. And so we did. And I guess you could say that I'm a producer in the sense that, like, a marketing kind of producer on this. I didn't really have a hand in the animation, but everything that came afterwards, I've been, so the reason why this landed in your lap is because I submitted it.
Exactly.
So there you go.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Here we are. Because when we first talked, I was like, yeah, which project or projects did you submit? And you're like, hang on a second, let me pull up my spreadsheet.
Like, right, right. So there's that. And then there's another project that I submitted called What to Do with Your Tabloid News. And that is from the Center for Learning Unlimited and its companion studio, Brainstorm Productions, where I am just an advisor, just a friend of the school. So it's a school for it's kindergarten through 12th grade for children on the autism spectrum. But 3 years ago, or 3 to 5 years ago, they started an animation career training program for adults on the autism spectrum. And so a friend of mine is a full-time animation instructor there. And so she had asked me if I would talk to the administration about what to do with these folks after they graduate from the program, and, you know, just how to
place them or find them a job.
Like now what? And she's like, please, would you just talk to them and just hold their hands and see what happens. So, so then that led to me being more involved with the school. And, so I've done various things for them over the last couple of years. And one of which was, I helped them to enter the Easter Seals Disability Challenge last year. Ooh. So it's kind of like a 48-hour film festival type of thing.
And so,
you know, we scrambled, put together this project, which was their first time collaborating as an actual animation pipeline. Before they had only done like individual projects. And so, you know, we put this thing together and, We didn't win the Easter Seals Challenge. We didn't place or anything like that, but we had this short film that was a calling card. And so, so I offered to, because I've submitted for film festivals for employers and myself too, for a long time. So I was like, hey, why don't we try this? Why don't we try to get it into some other festivals? Since we have this asset, we might as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Use it. It would be good exposure for the students. And so that's what we did. And so that's how that one landed on your doorstep. that's the story behind those.
That's awesome. Is there anything like you're currently working on that you want to talk about, or anything you're going to work on in the future? Like, I guess we're kind of rounding third here or whatever to wrap things.
Well, there are a few things that are sort of under wraps, so I won't spill the beans here. Yeah. But there is Young Captain Nemo that I'm working on with Rainshine with Sahil Bhargava, who's one of the major creative players behind that, as well as Jeffrey Reddick, who is the creator of the Final Destination franchise. We hired him.
Oh, wow.
So Jeffrey and I have been good friends for a long time. And so what happened was I found this book series called Young Captain Nemo, written by another friend of mine, Jason Henderson. It was a really, really cool contemporary retelling of the Captain Nemo story. Okay. I mean, it's really about his present day descendants and one boy in particular, but there is a hearkening back to the source material. So, but anyway, it is a new story actually, but there's a lot of, you know, it calls back to the cool. source material. So Rainshine optioned the books, and then we hired Jeffrey Reddick to adapt them into a screenplay. And now we're getting ready to start production on the first of three animated feature films.
That's cool.
So I'm working on that. And then I published an article yesterday about a friend of mine named Warren Davis, So that's another of my many projects. I write articles about just mostly entertainment related stuff that interests me. And so a friend of mine who I know is an actor, his name is Warren Davis. We've acted together on stage and in a short film. And he also happened true to form of most people in LA, he's a multi-hyphenate.
Right,
he's also a video game creator, and he created the video game Q-Bert, which was Yes, he created Q-Bert.
I want to see that guy's hand.
I'll do you one better. I'll send you the link to my article and you can read about. So he published a book, and the book is called Creating Q-Bert and Other Classic Video Games. So like the list of classic games that he's worked on is
amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. And so, so the book was just published like in the last few weeks, basically.
Incredible when we get off this interview.
And so I said, Warren, I would love to write a book review for you because he was promoting it on Facebook and grassroots marketing. I was like, well, let me just write a review and then I'll post it on LinkedIn and you'll sell some more books.
Exactly.
So that's what I did. And so the article is on geekinsider.com and it's about Warren's book. And then I have a fun fact in there about how I know Warren, and I knew Warren as an actor and then found out that he was
So funny, right?
You didn't. I know, it's hilarious. I remember that day too. I remember being in the theater at rehearsal and somebody saying like, Warren's video games or something. I was like, what do you mean Warren's video games? And they're like, oh yeah, he invented this famous game. You should ask him about it. Cause whoever it was that was telling me this knew that I worked in that business too. You guys must know each other's background.
Yeah,
I'm like, no, I don't. And then when he's like, oh yeah, Q-Bert, maybe you've heard of it. I was like, what?
So crazy.
I can't believe it. So yeah, so I'm proud of the article because he's using it also to do some more promotion, and he's going to be appearing at Game Developers Conference.
Yeah.
I think that's next week. He's going to do a postmortem on Q-Bert and other famous games, and so he can use the article just to raise awareness and hopefully get more attendees at his event.
That is awesome. Very cool. It's been awesome talking to you. I can probably make this interview 3 hours long. We were talking before the interview and you're like, hey, sure. Shouldn't we start recording? I'm like, actually, but it's been awesome talking to you, and everyone check out pinkpoodleproductions.com. Any like final words for the audience or anything you want to end on or?
Just thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for discovering me in the pile of all the submissions for your esteemed Tornado Film Festival. I am so grateful for that. And I look forward to future collaboration.
Absolutely. No,
maybe totally. In many ways.
Absolutely. 100% for sure. And everyone, thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading, and embrace your storm.
Tornado with Jonathan Nadeau. If you haven't yet, please subscribe now so you're first to hear new episodes with more stories of inspiration about the highs and lows of life and how embracing the storm is so much more fulfilling of a life than being crushed by the weight of the world. And until then, we hope you're inspired to do something, whether it's creating, participating, or learning, whatever leads you to your personal passion.